Squadron Leader Wagland, Reel 2. So you didn't say when you were called to go to work at Thamesford Station.
Well, it was in October. I couldn't give you the precise date because I'm from a local log and only show flights. But that was, I would say, October 42. I did a flight with, who was then Squadron Leader Boxer and his crew, to Holland, that flight. And then subsequently I went with him to Poland, which was a very long flight, for about 12 and a half hours, to go across Denmark, usually in at about Stettin, and then follow the railway round to Warsaw. The dropping zone was just beyond Warsaw, and they had to be very careful of dropping, it didn't get mixed up with the railway signal lights, with the lights that they'd be using on the ground for the drop. And so they were quite long flights. Usually finished up at Accrington on the way back and then coming back into Thamesford.
This was in Hudson's, was it?
No, Halifax's, which carried the whole bomb bay was petrol tank.
Presumably Hudson's wouldn't have been suitable for...
They did have long-range tanks, but I couldn't tell you how far we could have gone. The longest flight I recollect doing the Hudson for pickup operations was into the south of France, then on to Algiers, and then flying back from Algiers. But it wouldn't have been all that long compared with the flight to Poland, for example.
What were the arrangements on the ground in Poland to indicate that you'd got the right spot?
There'd be people on the ground to signal with torches. One of the problems anywhere in France or anywhere else was the lack of batteries for torches these people had, you know, dim lights. And I didn't think Poland was too bad, but in France, where you've got a lot of forests, and Halifax needs quite a big circle, low flying, to circuit a point, you've probably seen it, and then you're hidden by the woods from seeing it again, if you follow me. I used to go to one of the agents' schools, as it were, to just give a little talk on that subject when it comes to selecting sites for dropping. Selecting sites for pickups, of course, were rather more difficult. I had to find suitable, sizable area. Lysander needed, I think, 600 metres, and a Hudson, 1,000 metres. And... you need to be fairly free of high-tension cables and that sort of thing, clock towers, for approach and take-off. And the ground had to be in reasonable condition. One of the problems there is when the agent, the other side, is he's probably got a number of people he's got to get away, and he gets under enormous pressure, and his sense of judgment can deteriorate a bit as to... in the worst case of people landing under very muddy conditions... And having a job to get out, the French would produce their ditches to dig away, you know, try and put bracken in to try and make an oxen to pull, use oxen to pull aircraft out. And one case, Sir Robin Hooper, who unfortunately is dead now, who was one of the Lysander chaps, he got badly stuck and he had to burn his aircraft. And he was in the diplomatic service before and after the war. And he spoke French extremely well. And he went around with resistance boys, he was in civvy clothes, to find out, sort out new sites for landing, and did an excellent job. And then Wing Commander Hodges and myself went and fetched him out the next month. Getting back to this other period when I started at Thamesford, trying to get my nose in here and there for odd flights, and I flew one or two other people in 138, including the later squadron commander, a chap called Dickie Spears, who unfortunately got killed after the war. But mainly, I flew with... he was squadron leader Hodges to start with. He had a flight at the time I arrived there. And we did a trip together. We took General Marshall Cornwall, who was the general in charge of intelligence on the general staff. And he wanted to... It was just after the Germans had been cleared out of North Africa, and he wanted to do a circuit of his intelligence units. So with the Halifax, we took him to North Africa, to Algiers, and did a tour around Malta, Derna, Cairo, and so on. Well, then I flew... Picard, no doubt heard of Picard, he was commanding 161. And then when he left, Hodges took over the squadron. And I still flew him. Used to have a, what we called a scratch crew. But the... What I... we had an excellent wireless operator we normally flew with, a chap called Lofty Reed. And we got extremely well. Things seemed to click together. And we had a number of quite successful operations, both dropping and on pickups with Hudson. There's only one occasion when, I mean, the Lysander pilots, as you probably know, you've seen Group Captain Ferity, have you?
Yes.
Yeah. They flew on their own in Lysander, did their own map reading, etc. But on this one occasion to get Robin Hooper back, I asked Hodges that I could join him, and we put G in the aircraft. I was in the back cockpit facing backwards. I put G in to try and see if that would help us on our way. Well, both of us were occupied during the day, and what we didn't realise, we went to start off from Thamesford for Tangmere, where we took off. As soon as I switched G on, the coaxial cable was, of course, coming from the single engine in the front and upsetting the compass rather badly. So we had to have a working arrangement whereby when I wanted to use it, he'd go on his gyro and take it from there until I'd finished. But it wasn't terribly successful because we were over low cloud and we didn't get... G was very badly interfered with by the Germans, particularly on the French coast. So we didn't get much joy out of that. And what with their height, the G was not at all successful. So we had to turn back. And the next night we took off again and that went entirely by map reading. And that's where I noticed the difference between Lysander and Halifax. As I said before, with the Halifax, you have to do a very wide circuit to turn round a point. And if you're at low level, you're not map reading that pinpoint, you're map reading something else out here. Now, with the Lysander, you could turn on its wingtip and look straight down at the point you were circling. And of course, having made a pinpoint, which you could properly identify, you know, probably a small town or village with road, railway, level crossing gate, what have you, you do what we call a DR run. You time your run to the target area, maybe only 5 or 6 minutes. And then as you went along, you'd be probably see the signal come up from the ground, people on the ground, and you signal back, and then they give you clearance to land. And often there were men standing out with these torches to make landing lights, which was pretty dangerous for them.
DR standing for?
Holding the landing, you know, the torches to make the path, flight path.
But you said DR standing for?
Dead reckoning. And so that's how that was done. And I had a number of operations with Hodges, who, as you probably know, I don't know whether you've seen him yet.
No.
His most successful career, he went out after 161, he went out on the same operations in Burma and Malaya against the Japanese. And some Lysander boys were out there as well. And he was on Liberators out there, I think. But he was a permanent officer from Cranwell Cadet before the war. And he graduated to various posts, air ranks, so on, and finally retired as knighted as an Air Chief Marshal.
But you hadn't originally gone to Thamesford in order to do operations, do I understand?
Not strictly, no. Station Navigation Office was part of the headquarters in an administrative sense, where the operations were discussed each morning. We'd have a little conference, as it were, the station commander, the two squadron commanders, the intelligence bloke, the weatherman, and myself.
So it was up to you just to induce people to...
Yes, exactly, yes. Mm. I flew with 161 flight commander, Len Ratcliffe, who his navigator was in hospital at some knee trouble, so I got to look in there, you see. So that's how I got my few ops in.
Was it easy to induce them to let you go?
No, I wouldn't say there was any problems, really. When you know these people well, and you work with them.
Why did you especially want to go? For the excitement?
No, I felt I wanted the experience. I mean, if you're going to be discussing something, of course, it's useful to know what it's about. And, I like doing it. Enjoyment might be too high a word, as it were, for it. But I suppose it's fair to say you did enjoy doing it. It was interesting work. It was very different from bombing operations. You felt that, I think it's fair to say, that with bombing operations, you couldn't help but bomb civilians. If you're going for a major target in a town, that's how it goes. It's just as it went here in this country. But on these sort of operations, you were dropping agents and supplies to help resistance boys to be more selective, shall I say, in their work.
How close did you come to the agents themselves?
Sorry?
How close did you come to the agents themselves?
Well, you actually met them on the field. Of a pickup, you would gather them on board, of course, you see. And for the takeoff. In the case of General Georges, it was that we brought from France when I was with Fielden, because you had de Gaulle in Algiers, and Giraud was there. There was a bit of an argument going on, and Georges was being brought out, and that wasn't successful either. But we had to land on what was a rather pebbly area in the Massy Central, and we had to wait for his motorcade to turn up. Normally, he didn't spend much time on the ground, as you can imagine, and we had to wait for him to turn up. But
when would that have been that you brought George out from Massy Central?
That was in May 43.
Have you got the exact date?
Yeah, 19th. 19th of May 43.
What other details does your logbook give about
that? It doesn't. We're always told to be careful about security, and all I've got down here is ops south of France. Landed Maison Blanche, Algiers. We flew on, you see, because of the question of lack of light.
How long was your operation?
That was 7 hours into Algiers, including being on the ground. Then we flew back via Gibraltar.
And who was flying that?
Fielden, who became Sir Edward Fielden later. He's captain of the King's Flight and then the Queen's Flight. He's passed on now, unfortunately.
What did you make of General Georges?
Well, I'd be honest and say I barely saw him. I mean, I didn't have any possibility of conversing with him at all. We'd done our job of delivering, you know. Fielden dealt with that side and was handed over. But General Marshal Cornwall, the British general we took around on his intelligence inspection, as it were, a very nice man indeed. And as a side issue, he was interested in Roman remains. So on the map, he'd come up with his one-in-a-million map, see if we could circle around one of these remains, you know.
When have you got the dates when you took him round?
Okay, 24th of May, We picked him up at Herne and flew to Maison Blanche, Algiers. And normally you were required to go right round the Finisterre, you know, France, the northwest corner of France, and miss Portugal and come right round and driven a wide circuit. To cut that out, I cut across the north of Spain from San Sebastian across to Tarragona, and then by the Balearic Isles, which cut us down to a 7-hour flight, which was rather easier. And of course, you saw the lights of the Spanish towns. They were still lit, of course, notwithstanding the war. But and then from Algiers, we went on to Beaune, where we saw, from where we were staying at the aerodrome, we saw a lot of flak going on at Beaune, where the Germans were still operating out of Sicily to attack the place. Then Tunis, Malta. Malta was then still under quite a bit of pressure from Sicily.
What kind of points did Marshal Cornwall want you to fly over?
These were on a map, not a chart, but on a map, in large letters were printed what were Roman remains, you know, amphitheatres and what have you. And he was interested to see them, and as I sort of circle around and have a look at these. I had what was for me an unusual experience in the navigation terms, from Malta to fly to Cairo. I selected a place on the coast, looking at the map in Egypt, to enter, and I had no, we were in daylight, I had no navigation apparatus, radio or anything. And so I did it by drift with the bomb sight, and just knelt over the bomb sight, just watching the drift on the waves, and it went bang on. When we got to this place on the coast, it was a little fishing village. You look at the map, you think it's a town, but it was a little fishing village. But they went to Cairo West, which was the big military aerodrome at Cairo, and a very busy place. And then we stayed there about 3 days while General Marshal Cornwall did his business.
But is the military significance of what he wanted to do was that he wanted to...
He was visiting his intelligence units, you see. Because he was responsible on the general staff for the intelligence organisation.
In North Africa?
I would say probably generally. I think it was pretty high level, but that's, of course, where all the activity was rather at that time.
You said that you started off with a trip to the Netherlands. Does that stick out in your mind?
Not especially, no. One Netherlands trip that did, I did with Wing Commander Hodges, as he was. We'd been a long layoff in Holland. I think part of the problem was, well known afterwards, that both in Holland and northern France, the Germans had got control of some of the resistance apparatus, you know, sending false messages across and so on. And it rather dropped away. And also, Holland was a very dodgy country to fly over because of an area like the Zuid Zee. If you're flying over that in moonlight, you stick out like a sore thumb for German fighters. But it decided we'd have a go, and four of us went in. Wing Commander Hodges, I was navigating for him, and these three others, and only two of us came out. And we had a request from the chap, we were dropping one container to this man between the Zuider Zee and the North Sea, and so that we came round this way to be flying out to sea, and he asked us to keep our engines throttled back until we got clear, said if we didn't disclose his position. And that we did, and we sort of cruised out with the flak tower standing there. We were no height at all.
Were you aware at all, at any stage during the war, of the fact that the Germans and the Netherlands were playing back the agents?
I don't recollect it specifically. I may be getting a bit hazy, because the problem was really in SOE, where this was going on and didn't realise it, and somebody called into subsequent reports. If an agent was being compelled to send a message, he'd fudge his code name in some way, or the end of the message, which would indicate it was a dud. That was the intention. And apparently this wasn't noticed, this end, by somebody. There was a big argument about that after the war.
But was there anything from the RAF point of view which made you suspicious about the Netherlands?
No, I don't think so. I don't... certainly that far, speaking in personal terms, my experience there was very little being shot at because, that somebody was waiting for the reception for us, anything like that. You had these... Verity's book is very good on the pickup operations, for she had to do a lot of research. But the case there, again with Hodges and Hudson, we'd landed on an operation by the Loire, and the German people were watching, German intelligence were watching. And they presumably weren't as much about us as watching the chaps who were getting off and going in. That's because this chap, what's his name, was acting as a double agent.
You're referring to Derrico there.
That's right. He controlled some of these landing operations, and very well too, from an aviation point of view. You get the difference in that. His operations were very quiet. Another area where we went, where Paul Rivière was operating field for us, it seems as though the whole darn village had turned out, you know.
Why was that?
Well, so many there. And also...
But why was his operations so noisy?
Well, that was maybe to do with his area. I think the gendarmerie helped as well, you know, and the German soldiers were just kept out of it. But not always, because, I mean, some of our Lysander chaps were shot at when they were taking off from some of these fields.
Did you come across Derrico during the war?
Yes. He was... I don't know if I can pinpoint the year for this, but he was at our... He was staying at our station in army uniform. And he was... this was about Christmas time. And he was a very cheery sort of chap, you know. And Macmillan, who was Boxer's navigator, myself, had quite a bit to do with him, just in a comradely way, as it were. And he still carried on, of course, doing operations after that, the other side.
Have you any specific memories of him as a man and how he behaved?
He certainly behaved in quite a normal fashion, and quite a... I think you'd accept him, you would anybody else, as quite a normal chap. It was only, I think, when they found things were going a bit odd that some of our people were asked to try and bring him back.
Were you ever aware whether or not the agents you were carrying were SOE people or SIS or anything about them, or were you just kept ignorant on the need to know this?
Well, to your particular flight, perhaps not. Although, I would say who were the escorting officers would probably indicate who we were operating for. But I don't think, as far as Phil was concerned, there was any distinction, as it were. They all wanted jobs done, probably more than one could do. And
were there any parts of Europe which you particularly disliked going to because of the increased danger?
I wouldn't say so, no. This may depend on the period. Latter stage when I was in Thamesford, I did relatively little flying, particularly when Hodges left. But Denmark seemed to become something of a danger spot, because there were two people, Brian Eckes is one, who was shot down there, and another chap who was shot down there. And of course you use Denmark not only on its own account, but to go across into Poland. And of course there were the Norwegian operations, which we used to go up to the north of Scotland, Kinloss, to work there. And I didn't do one myself, but I believe they were pretty dodgy ops, because flying amongst the fields, the wind directions were all over the place, so trying to calculate winds was extremely difficult.
I think that you said that you went to Thamesford in October 1942 and stayed there 6 months, did you?
No, it was Bomber Command headquarters, 6 months. Thamesford, October 42 until September 45.
And what can you tell me about Thamesford itself as a station to operate from?
It was a normal RAF station in its basic an admin term, shall I say. As far as engineering went, they had the same aircraft as were to handle as bombers would have. When it came to the type of work, then of course the people handling supplies were something you wouldn't get on a normal station. You had an RAF officer looking, you always had a parachuting section looking after the air crews, but he traditionally had the job of looking after parachuting for the agents who were going to be dropped. And they came, of course, under escorts and probably been trained. For example, Station 41, the number of SOE types were held there, ready to go on ops. And they'd been trained. There was a chap called Ray Willer, you might have heard of initially, an army chap who's a Canadian and now retired down to Florida, I think. But he's quite a remarkable starter, because being Canadian, he could ski well. And he went and joined the Finns against the Russians when the scrap first started out. And then he was succeeded by a chap, Charles Tyson, who I got on with very well, who's living in Australia. I've recently been in communication with him. And they trained these people in parachuting at Ringway. And they're also nearby. They were taught the other aspects of their work, you know, with their arms and this and that. And then they were held at Station 41, just before, really, leading up to their op. And when they went, depended on weather, as much as any, both ways, of course.
I wonder if you could take me through your logbook on the Thamesford section, please, and if you could go through the operations that you went on, and if anything comes to mind as you go through them, comment on specific operations that you went on. If you could give them with the dates and where you went to.